Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith.
Hello.
Hello. And one of our contributors, Ashanti Omkar.
Hi.
Hi, both of you. So this week we are looking at The Railway Children Return, Nitram. What do we think?
I think it's Nitram, but Nitram. In the film they say Nitram.
There we go. Nitram. Minions, The Rise of Gru, and The Princess. But before we get onto those, what have you guys been watching this week? What have you been looking at aside from these films? Ashanti, what have you been up to?
Okay, I've got three things to talk about very quickly. One is Miss Marvel, as Jane would have definitely known about because I'm gushing all the time about it. The latest episode is absolutely fantastic. They've gone to Karachi. It's about a young Pakistani superhero, the first South Asian female superhero in the MCU, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This show is so deeply into the roots of this character. It's one of the best origin stories I've certainly seen in the MCU, and given to us in these six chunks is an absolutely fabulous way to kind of segue into the Marvels in 2023, where she'll be joining Monica Rambeau and Captain Marvel. And we've got Only Murders in the Building season two. Woohoo! I am so excited about it because I love the first one. This one has some very interesting new characters joining in, including Cara Delevingne. Yes, she's fabulous in this. She's a new character to it. She has a kiss with Selena Gomez. I've just given you a little spoiler there. And let's just say season two is packing a punch already. It's hit Disney Plus and London Indian Film Festival. I'm hugely part of the programming team, been with the festival since 2011. And there's an equally named but brilliant film called The Rapist that Jane knows all about. And it is showing at the BFI this Saturday. And all I can say is watch it. I won't give you any spoilers because
yes,
I feel like even the name, The Rapist, is a spoiler. So go watch it.
Neil, what have you been watching?
Well, I too have been enjoying Only Murders in the Building season two. It's good to get the gang back together. Not wholly convinced yet by Cara Delevingne and her contribution to the story. We'll have to see how that develops. But the rest of it, I'm enjoying a great deal. I also enjoyed the BBC drama Sherwood, written by James Graham, which was really kind of complex and intricate look at the legacy of the miner strike in Nottinghamshire village. And involves a various sort of murders taking place with a sort of Robin Hood element. I enjoyed that. Mm. And it came to the conclusion last night on BBC One, but it's available to watch on the BBC iPlayer. And the other thing I watched to kind of get me in the mood for Thor, Love and Thunder, I watched Chris Hemsworth in Spiderhead, Netflix film directed by Joseph Kaczynski, in which he plays rather out of character, a scientific genius who is conducting all sort of weird hallucinogenic experiments on these rather less than willing guinea pigs on a remote island. Enjoyable to watch, fun to see him, you know, in a very different role than he normally plays, and Miles Teller too, as one of his sort of guinea pigs. Yeah, so I enjoyed that, and I'm looking forward very much to Thor, Love and Thunder when I get to see it very soon.
Yes, yes, yes.
Cool.
Yes, all of that, Neil.
Yes, I've watched a secrety screening of something I can't talk about that gave me immense joy and will, I think, give other people immense joy when they see it. That's all I can say about that.
Can I ask, was it as good as Elvis?
Elvis is currently my number one film of the year, and it's hard to beat. So it didn't beat that. I'm going for my fourth viewing this weekend. But no, it was extremely good. So shall we talk about now what we can see this week? We can't see that secrety one for another weeks, but let's talk about what we can watch this week. It's time to wave your bloomers. It's time for this.
I was brought here from London when I was a little girl, and it was a big change.
Look at all the stars you can see.
Let's play a game.
Hide and seek.
Coming. Ready or not? Hello?
So this is The Railway Children Return. Neil, tell us, who are the Railway Children this time around, and is Jenny Agutter in it?
Well, you remember Jenny Agutter was one of the Railway Children, the original Railway Children, which came out, I believe, in the early 1970s, and has become this sort of totemic emblem of innocence and charm and the wonderful things we love when we sit down to watch a movie on a Saturday afternoon on television. This is a, I suppose you would call it a sequel, or as has become the word, a Lego sequel, in the fact that it involves characters, at least one character from the original film, and that is, as you mentioned, Jenny Agutter, reprising her role of Bobby, now as a grandmother who is welcoming a new set of railway children. There's three children, and they have been evacuated from Manchester, which is feeling the brunt of the Luftwaffe, and they've been moved out into the country where they've lived next to a railway with Bobby, played by Jenny Agutter from the original film. And there's a fourth railway child who is a sort of runaway American GI, very young GI, who for various reasons has sort of run away from his squadron. That's basically the setup, and they get up to lots of fun by the railway tracks.
You're obviously aware of the original. Have you? Did you watch that as a kid? Was it something that you enjoyed? And did this give you the nostalgia hit you needed?
Well, I actually rewatched the original just before seeing the new one, just to see how the two would compare. I mean, the original was so charming and lots of fun. It's got humour and some great character actors and a surprising amount of sex. There's actually a sort of off-camera sex scene involving Bernard Cribbins, Station Master, which I wasn't, I didn't quite remember seeing it as a child. This tries very hard, I would almost say too hard, to replicate that yoldy English charm. It's directed by Morgan Matthews, whose film X and Y was quite a critical success a while ago. It's shot in key locations in the original film, including Haworth, where the Bronte Parsonage Museum is, Oakworth Station, and the Keighley and Worth Valley Railway. So they're certainly trying their very best to sort of get the feel of it. But I just didn't feel it had that charm and that sort of innocence of the original. It seemed a bit too calculated for me. And I didn't find the new railway children as charming as the originals.
Ashanti, was it doing it for you?
Well, you know, honestly speaking, I actually really enjoyed the film. But when I thought back afterwards was when a lot of what Neil has said has come in, because there was a lot of box ticking happening. You know, you had the postman with Down syndrome. You know, you had this kind of whole white savior thing coming out very strongly in this film. And that for me just was a bit irksome because, you know, yes, it was good for representation. It's exactly Neil's word, calculated, felt about right, just because of all of that, because it's all about this young black officer who was too young to be in the army, who comes in to this place and they're trying to get him home. But the film as a whole, let's just say that I went with two children and the kids, especially the little kind of five-year-old boy, absolutely adored the film. So anyone who's not looking for this, you know, I'm nitpicking, aren't I? So when I nitpick, I'm saying, oh, it's got this, it's box ticking, it's this. But the film as a whole was actually quite sweet and very watchable, you know, wonderful vistas. I kind of felt, I mean, I grew up reading more kind of Enid Blyton type books. So it kind of took me back to that world. And I just wanted to go back and have like a nice little cheese and pickle sandwich afterwards. And,
bring a little picnic hamper with some bottles of ginger beer.
This is exactly it, you know, and I like the fact that these kids didn't see color and they were out to just help these black soldiers who were in their town, who were from America. And when they saw bad things being done to them, the kids' reactions for me felt really pure and very sweet. And I really like that because I thought this is how children are until they have things that they've been taught, you know, it's nature versus nurture. And they have that nurturing attitude. And I love the kids in this. The little girl, Lily, I mean, she's feisty. I was exactly like that when I was a child. And Abe as this soldier, he kind of really stole our hearts. Well, I stole my heart anyway. And I just thought that it would have been good if they wanted to do this box ticking, it would have been better for them to find some people behind the scenes, writers, for example, who could help them, you know, kind of build this to make it feel more modern, because there were black and Asian people in those towns back in the day. So what they've done is they've tried to just say, oh, let's just kind of make this look like we've made it very kind of diverse and for a newer audience. But I feel like they didn't really put their back into getting all of those things done very, very carefully. But saying that, I have to say, I did enjoy it. I would take my niece and nephew to see it because one of them is half black, one of them is black. And I'd like them to see the representation of these kids helping a black soldier who's young. That really felt great to me. And the little five-year-old after the film, he was put in front of a kind of step and repeat board to talk about it. And that's what he said. He said his favorite character was Abe. And I think Abe will kind of steal our hearts. And I would say watch it, give it a watch, especially if you have children, because there are lots of messages in this movie that I was a fan of.
For some context, the script is written by Danny Brocklehurst, and it's come from a story that was created by the producer, who has black heritage. In fact, her grandfather used to sort of go around doing speeches and stuff, and was a conscientious objector during World War II, and used to talk about sort of race in speeches and things. So it's come from a good place and a good intention. And it's also weaving in this idea of a real life event that did happen near Haworth, the Bamber Bridge riots, where a load of GIs rioted with white military police one night in Bamber Bridge because they were being abused and arrested for, you know, trumped up charges. And there was an act of racism going on, and it sparked a riot. GIs were court-martialed and hung during the war, but a larger amount of black GIs were hung for court-martial offences in the UK during the war. So that's the sort of background that I think they're sort of trying to place this story against, which I think will irk some people who enjoy the traditional bloomers, petticoats and my daddy scenario of the original. But then it doesn't go far enough for really, truly modern audiences who want to see more of that. It's very softly done. Yeah. So it sort of falls between two stools for me. I was on set of this, and, you know, they were really taking great care to make sure that they replicated all of the sort of scenes that they had in the first film. So, as you mentioned, Neil, the Bronte Parsonage is in there, which was the doctor's house in the first film and is now their house. Jenny Agutter is there, and it's sort of, you know, the emblem of the fact that it's okay to like this film. They're not ripping off the old one because she's actually come back for it. So I like the intention, but I'm not sure it actually works.
I think I would have preferred a straight remake of the original with Jenny Agutter in another role, which is something she's done before.
She did it in 2000, didn't she? She played Mother in the last iteration. Yeah, it's very tricky, and I'd be interested to see what audiences make of it. But for now, would you say go and see this? Is it worth your money on a Saturday night?
I personally think so. I feel like, despite my reservations with certain aspects of it, and hearing this history from you, Jane, has made me realize why you are skeptical of what they've done with it. But I still think it is a worthy watch, especially because it's that kind of nostalgic look, and the way they've been meticulous in bringing that to the big screen, it makes it worth a watch, I feel.
Providing the trains are running, go and see the Railway Children.
That is a problem, isn't it? You might need some bloomers to start a train, never mind stop one. Okay, so the Railway Children is in cinemas from Friday, and take a picnic, as Ashantius suggests. Okay, shall we move on then to our next film? Very different. Moving from Yorkshire to Tasmania now with this.
When he was a little boy, we used to play a game at the fabric shop in town. He'd go off and hide in all the big tall rolls of fabric, and then I'd try and find it. He loved it. I loved it. But then this one day, I went to find him, and he wasn't there. He lived everywhere. Not in the silks, not in the cottons. Ran into all the shops, strangers were stopping to help me, tears streaming down my face.
What did you do?
I gave up and went back to the car.
So this is Nitram, which is Martin backwards. Ashanti, who is Nitram?
Let me just say that just you saying those words has shaken me to the core, because this is one of the most affecting films I've seen this year, and I've seen a few. This one is all about a neurodivergent young man who loves dangerous things. You know, even from a young age, he loves dangerous things, loves playing with fire in every sense of the word. It's based on Martin Bryant, who, you know, committed such a heinous crime in Tasmania in 1996. At Port Arthur, it was a massacre that happened where, well, guns were sold, let's say, to this boy who should never have had guns. I mean, by the point he was sold the guns, he was already a man. And this film, it premiered at Cannes. And, you know, the young man, Caleb Landry Jones, who plays Nitram, he even won Best Actor for it. And I'm not surprised at all, because the film is absolutely stunning. It is very current. It very much is a parallel to what's going on in the US nearly every week. And the way they have brought this to life, I mean, Justin Kurzel, who has directed this film, has really done, in my opinion, a fabulous job with it. What can I say? I mean, the film, apart from shaking me to the core, also made me think very deeply about this character. Judy Davis plays Nitram's mother, based on Carlene Bryant. And this is all kind of based on real life people. And it's like an astounding story. And all I can say is, please watch it to understand why gun laws in certain countries should not be the way they are.
Yeah, and let's just be very clear that we don't see this attack. The film isn't about showing us what happened on the day, which we've seen in previous films. It's about the run-up to this and what might have triggered it, no pun intended. Neil, it's Justin Kurzel here as director, obviously famous for Snowtown and the recent Ned Kelly film. Did you like it? Did you think it did what he was trying to do?
Well, it's a very powerful and grueling watch. It comes with a sense of dread because you know that something really bad is going to happen. Something so bad that to explain why the film is called Nitram, firstly, because the character, that was a rather kind of cruel nickname to signify that the character was backwards. The people he knew called him his name backwards. But it's also a way of actually not saying his real name, which is a name that in Australia carries an awful lot of traumatic cachet. I mean, and it's a very controversial film for that result. I mean, this was the worst mass shooting in Australia, you know, conducted by a single person, I believe still to this day. It's a story which is incredibly kind of traumatic for people who still have memories of it. If there was anything good that came out of it, Australia did very quickly afterwards pass some of the strictest gun laws, I think, anywhere in the world, which is where the topicality of this film comes in with recent events in America in particular. Although, The sad thing is that whenever this film is released, it would be topical. It's a great performance, like you said, from Caleb Landry Jones. You know, it's off-putting, and yet you feel kind of sympathy for him, and yet you don't really want to be with him. It's a very sort of push-pull effect you have. The other fine performance is from Essie Davis, who plays this rather kooky heiress. Essie Davis is actually the director's wife, and she gives in a really sort of odd and strange and
very Grey Gardens.
Yeah, very moving performances. The sort of Harris who takes Nitram under her wing, and there's obviously consequences to that for both of them. The only issue I have, and it's an issue you kind of have with any film that kind of tackles traumatic and devastating real life events, is that are you seeking to shed light on them, or are you some way sort of propagating their weird legacy? It's we might talk about that in another context later in the podcast, but there is a real sense that maybe you should leave things alone, and how much can you really shed light on something by focusing this amount of interest on the perpetrator?
I agree with that, Neil. When I was watching it, I found it to be strange to give so much credence to somebody that literally when he was arrested, when photographers took photos of him, the pictures of him were taken off the photographers, the press, because they didn't want to sort of add to his legend. Because when he was arrested, he wanted to know how many people he'd killed. He was very interested in that. And, you know, that whole idea of why are we giving more airtime to somebody who revels in that sort of thing, when, you know, the Tasmanian government and the Australian government are very clear about not wanting to give him any more airtime or any space really in their lives, because he's taken all of these lives. But then again, as you say, it's this, you know, push-pull of like, we do have to understand our monsters, and what is it that drives them. And the thing that I found was that I found him incredibly opaque. I don't think I did understand what drove him. There's a hint that perhaps he was tipped over the edge by rage about his father, who had a disappointment, that there was a very strange relationship with his mother. And he was also, as you mentioned, the heiress, that money came into his hands, that perhaps a person like him shouldn't have had money that he to then spend on equipment he shouldn't have had. But I didn't really understand why I needed to watch it and why I needed to feel this uncomfortable watching it. It's got this sort of discordant soundtrack all the way through it. If it's not, you know, wasps buzzing, it's even in some scenes where people are having a chat, there's the buzz of a lawnmower droning in the background. There's this constant sort of cacophony going on. And as you say, it keeps you constantly on edge. Like July the 22nd, the Greengrass film, I sort of had no comprehension, really, and to some extent, United 93, of why I needed to watch this when the facts are very well known and they're horrendous. And also, I don't know that it was particularly engaging. It was very beautiful, an incredible sort of virtuoso performance from Landry Jones, but just felt like arty for art's sake. And so I didn't love it, and I didn't sort of think that there was a point to it, unfortunately. So at the other end of the scale to you, Ashanti.
Well, all I can say is I hope that people in America watch this film. I personally just think that in the UK, we don't have the same level of issue with gun violence, with this kind of crime, because you can't go into a shop and buy guns in the UK, whereas you can in America. And I feel like this is a film that they've released in time for America to see it, perhaps. I agree with Jane that it is a difficult watch. I personally would say perhaps watch this at home, because you're going to feel so icky. And I don't know how you'll feel when you come out of watching a film like this in the cinema.
It will be interesting to see how it does box office. Like, is there an appetite for people to go and see this sort of film? I would hope so, because obviously it's a film that, you know, asks for debate afterwards. It's a film that doesn't have a superhero in it. You know, we do want people to go and see this sort of film so that they do continue to be made. And it's fine if you don't love it, right?
Yeah, agreed.
I was looking back at something which the screenwriter said. He said that, you know, he had obviously sort of watched these events unfold on television, and he's asking himself, you know, who would do such a thing? Does Nitram answer that question? We're not entirely sure it does.
Okay, so that is Nitram, whatever you want to call him, and that is out in cinemas this Friday. Okay, so now it's time for alternative line reading, and Neil is going to do this line in a Tasmanian accent. So he thinks.
David, please be rational. Let's go to Dr. Hirsch.
Ashanti, any idea? Remember, of course, that this is somebody we've talked about already on the pod from their back catalogue. Who is this and what film is it from?
So we're going back to the lovely Jenny and Railway Children. And she was in this horror comedy, An American Werewolf in London.
Correct.
And, it's just one of those kind of, you're just thinking, that's an interesting title.
American Werewolf in London, absolute classic. And this is what it sounds like in her cut glass English accent.
And I'm going to the cops.
David, please be rational. Let's go to Dr. Hurst. Yeah.
Okay, it's time to move on now to this.
Ayana banana iguana chipolata.
But also Stuart Smith, the captain.
Willkommen. Good flight.
Hello, Peanut?
Oh, yes, please.
Peanut. Peanut.
Okay, vamos.
To introduce this film, I probably should do it in the Minion style. So it's like, banana. Minion, my dog. Neil, what's Minions, The Rise of Gru about?
How can I improve upon that, Jane? This
banana.
Is Minion... This is Minions, The Rise of Gru, which technically is the fifth film in the Despicable Me franchise, in the fact we've had three Despicable Me films and one Minions spin-off. I guess what this is really is a kind of combination of the two. It's a prequel slash sequel in which you have Gru, voiced as ever by Steve Carell, found as a young I would guess, 10-year-old in his early teens, on his sort of taking his first steps in the world of supervillainy, helped and hindered as ever by the minions, the little yellow tic-tac-like hench persons who follow him around and attempt to do his bidding with hilarious results. This time around, he wants to join the Vicious Six, which are a sextet of evildoers who are causing havoc in the sort of mid-1970s, which is the setting of the film. These are kind of very outlandish sort of supervillains, voiced by actors including Taraji P. Henson, Danny Trejo, Jean-Claude Van Damme, very briefly. But very briefly indeed. I wasn't even sure he said anything in the film. When Gru turns up for an interview to join this band, they get laughing out of the room. So he decides to get his own back by stealing this precious amulet that they need to pull off their latest heist, which the minions promptly mislay. So you have this rather sort of enjoyable but convoluted story where the minions go off in search of trying to, you know, rescue Gru, who's been kidnapped. One minion goes off to try and find the amulet that he's lost. And meanwhile, Gru, sort of having been kidnapped by a member of the Vicious Six who's been thrown out of it, played by Alan Arkin, sort of forms a little bit of a sort of grandfatherly bond with him. So it's there's a lot of comedy, a bit of sentiment, and rather too much plot.
Yes, agreed. Why do we need this much? Like, I really loved Scarlet Overkill and that Minions one. You know, then we had obviously Gru and his brother as a sort of plot device. And now we're sort of, it's the prequel, but it's like, he's now, what, a 10-year-old? And that I found quite strange as well. Yeah, a lot going on. Did it do it for you, Ashanti?
I love the fact that the minions were described. I like Neil's description as, was it TikToks?
Yellow Tic-Tacs.
Tic-Tacs, yes, Tic-Tacs. For me, you know, in the film when he says they're like tater tots with too much denim, where did they get that denim? I have to say that I don't know why I love minions. And somebody had described this as like you have to be on high on drugs to like this or very small child. But to be honest, I just really enjoyed it just because I'd been watching these really serious films all week. And then I came into this and just immersed my world into the, it was like beautiful, beautiful animation, super fun soundtrack. I mean, songs like Funky Town for me are just, you know, just kind of takes me back to childhood. And I really liked all of that. I like the fact that, you know, you had people like Michelle Yeoh in this and Taraji, as Neil mentioned, Dolph Lundgren, you know, giving voice, Russell Brand. Julie Andrews, you know, yes, as Gru's mother, you know, and the Vicious Six. I mean, I just thought, well, they're just trying to do a Sinister Six on us, aren't they? Just to kind of bring a bit of a MCU into their world. I just enjoyed the film. I think it's a film I would take my nephews and nieces to. I enjoyed it. I liked all those colors. I've never taken drugs, so this is my version of a trip, I suppose.
They can put that on the poster. I'm sure they'd want that. I've never taken drugs. This is my version of a trip, Ashanti. Yeah, I mean, but if you're not a kid, are you going to bother with this? I mean, Minions do have a soft spot in a lot of people's hearts. You know, they're not just for children. Is it good enough to entertain somebody who doesn't have kids?
What I noticed having watched it, I mean, I watched the original Minions as preparation to get into that kind of crazy world. But I noticed a bit of a kind of tension, a creative tension there. You know, you've got the Minions who are gloriously unchangeable. They're always, they're wonderful kind of slapstick creations who are always going to get up to the most incredible and amusing scrapes. And then you have Gru, who is a character who is supposed to be evolving. Therefore, in this character, you know, he wants to be villainous, but he realizes that maybe, you know, it's more important to have a family, and the usual sort of soppy homily that you get with these films. So it seems as if, like, you know, is this a Minions film? Is this a Gru film? It's, you know, you're trying to be both things to both people. Possibly there's some kind of creative tension behind the scenes, and in order to get Steve Carell to be involved, you have to give him something to do. But I would rather if he hadn't actually been in the film at all and you just had the Minions in the 70s, I think that would have been great fun. The franchise is a bit of a weird phase at the moment. You know, it's trying to kind of catch up with the Despicable Me movies, but it's doing so by sort of putting more and more focus on the minions, who were always supposed to be subordinate characters.
Yeah.
The franchise itself feels like a little bit of a weird tipping point. Which way is it going to go? And I think the way it will probably go is we'll see a lot more Minions movies, maybe a Minions TV series, certainly lots more Minions merchandise. Whether people are going to be that interested in where kind of, you know, do we really want to see Gru as a teenager? Gru as a 20-something?
No, I don't care.
Gru's first mortgage?
No, not interested.
His first mortgage.
I just want Bob and all of his little friends to do stupid things and get his face stuck in things and get his eye stuck in his head. And, you know, like, that's what I want to watch. And I would totally watch a TV show. 20-minute bite-sized sort of bits of Minions madness is exactly where I want to go with this. And I think that's what I found sort of quite fatiguing watching the film, is like, I don't want to watch this much of it with all of this extra stuff thrown in. Like, let's just throw Michelle Yeoh in, who you mentioned, just as this sort of whole side action thing about teaching them kung fu, and like ripped a page out of Turning Red and shoved that in because they're like, that's good, that will do that. And then yeah, as you say, they're sort of like stealing from sort of the bad guys sort of element, yes, as well.
And they brought a bit of Top Gun as well, didn't, yep, they, with the minion flying a plane. A cute, yeah, side.
They were getting that Mach 10 from the takeoff and landing, weren't they? Yeah, it does feel like there's just too many things in the pot, doesn't it?
Yes, but, you know, hey, there was dancing, and it just, I think to answer Neil's question, would you go there without children? I think no. It would be crazy to go and watch this, you know, as a bunch of adults, unless you were really keen on some kind of trip. But you could go there with the kids and you'll really enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay, so if you fancy The Minions, The Rise of Gru, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, final film then for this week. So from henchman to Her Royal Highness now, it's this.
I think we've got an unhealthy obsession.
Isn't she incredible?
I think she's very close to being a monster.
She has a sick mind.
She likes to be with people.
She likes to be bloody well watched.
That's ridiculous.
She has been humiliated.
When you put a modern person in an ancient institution, they will be destroyed.
The monarchy is in danger of too much publicity.
At what point British people say, I don't want to hear anymore.
So this is The Princess, a documentary about Princess Diana. Another one, Ashanti. What's different about this one?
Well, let's just say that don't get confused with the other The Princess, which is like an American dark fantasy action comedy, which is going to be, I believe, hitting Disney Plus at some point soon. So there are two, and they're both coming out around the same time, and it's all very confusing. This one is a documentary. It's a feature documentary. And this time you've got kind of highly decorated director Ed Perkins, who I actually met a few days ago at the screening. And he has done Tell Me Who I Am. And this is him taking footage of Princess Di and her interviews, newspaper clippings, and seamlessly turning it into an, you know, like, I don't know if you saw Amy by Asif Kapadia, yeah, but this has a similar feel. He has tried to do the same thing with Princess Di's life. And of course, most of us have just kind of watched Kristen Stewart playing Princess Di in Spencer. So we are very fresh in our knowledge of what happened with her, or what we thought happened with her. And this really is like, unlike the Elizabeth movie, which had all those quirky pieces of music and those different chapters that came out, this one does it without much of that narration. I felt like he had picked out some stuff that I just had not known. For example, that bit where Prince Charles will say, oh, she was a very fetching 16-year-old, which I just kind of went, oh!
Yes, his publicist might have advised him otherwise nowadays.
Otherwise, exactly, you know, and then the bits of her in her beautiful kind of orange jacket and purple skirt and purple shoes at the Taj Mahal, her kind of meeting Pavarotti and, you know, Imran Khan. And, you know, the other thing that shocked me was about her uncle attesting that she was a virgin, because apparently a royal must marry a virgin girl. So the royal can be whatever, do whatever he wants, because obviously the royal men do everything they want to do. But, you know, it's interesting, they'd picked out Sarah Ferguson talking as well at one point. And I just thought there were lots of bits in this. Yes, I knew that story. Yes, I've watched it again and again. Yes, I've watched The Crown. Yes, I watched Spencer. But this actually did bring an alternate dimension of these little bits that in 2022 we'll all gasp at and say, what kind of virginity test did they do for her? Because, I mean, I grew up in, you know, I will mention this a lot, that in the patriarchy, I've grown up where I was expected to stay a virgin all the way till marriage, da-da-da-da-da. And so for me, it was really interesting that Diana, you know, age 16 and getting married age 19, she was only 19, which again was quite normal. My mom was 19 when she you know, married my dad. And these are things that I probably didn't put together and piece together till I saw it in this documentary. So kudos to Ed Perkins for picking up those kind of very interesting bits. And Jane and I had met at the Elvis premiere. Jane took me with her, and we were talking about the culpability of audience, because the audience and the press, the reason the press wanted so much of Diana was that the audience wanted so much of Diana. And this film, I felt, gave us more of a view of that culpability of the audience, like the Elvis film gave, than any other films I've seen about Diana, because we knew the Paps were there. We knew they were annoying, but we didn't realize to the extent till I think this film. So from that perspective, I feel like it is a film that's really worth watching, and a film that really delves into her life in, I guess, a slightly different way from everything else.
Did it inform you, Neil?
What we should say about the film is that it's, as opposed to The Crown or Spencer, which attempts to sort of offer more kind of psychological portrait, you know, what was Diana thinking, you know, how did she behave behind closed doors, that kind of thing. The film is entirely really how she was viewed, how she was photographed, how she was filmed, how she was discussed and debated, not just by the media and by pundits, by celebrities or by the man on the street, man and woman in the street. There's various kind of vox pops are kind of put through the film. I suppose what it did remind me of, as someone who's lived through this, just how much Diana's life and what she did and where she went and what she wore just informed the national conversation. It became like a national obsession. You know, we talked about Nitram earlier about the sort of the value of going back to these kind of events, but I suppose there is a value here because it really just showed how we were all under this kind of collective delusion. You know, there was no person there. There was a symbol. There was somebody who we could kind of, like, you know, take as our own. It's almost like she was a member of our own family. But of course she wasn't. She was an individual with her own kind of life and her own traumas and her own agency. And we didn't really care about that. So it is very instructive, particularly when you look at how, you know, the discussion relating to sort of William and Harry and Meghan, and also like the next generation. Look how much we all sort of looked at Louis on the balcony and sort of like, you know, obsessing about him now. There is a real kind of question to be asked about what are we doing when we kind of, like, you know, take these public figures and we kind of subject them to this merciless gaze. And is that fulfilling a void in ourselves? Is that, or are we just kind of just too damn curious, and we need to kind of like take a step back, like Tom Hanks recently told a paparazzi.
Yes,
there's something instructive about that. And I think what I did learn about it was, like, you know, maybe we need to sort of reappraise how our relationship to people in the public eye, to politicians, to particularly to royalty, maybe even ask us, how would we feel if we were in that position? We probably wouldn't like it, and maybe that's what we should take away from films like this.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that the lack of sort of narrative or editorial sort of drive on this, where it's literally just unfolds for you, take the meaning from it, whoever watches it, whatever. And that was what I took from it. And, you know, I found the footage of Prince Charles doing a pheasant shoot and hunting. I conferred on that much more meaning than obviously when it was filmed by somebody just watching Prince Charles go about his hunting, shooting and fishing business, that, you know, we are part of that ecosystem when we hunt celebrities, because, you know, the paparazzi are delivering pictures because we need them. We want to see them, and we buy the newspapers and the magazines that they are put in. And equally, the idea that these celebrities are disposable, like pheasants, you know, there'll be another one being bashed out of the bushes. If we don't like that one, we can take that one down, rip it down. If that celebrity has health issues and has to go away for a bit, where's our next pheasant being beaten out of the bushes. So yeah, I definitely took that sort of aspect away from it. And I thought that was really interesting. But also I just loved, as you say, she was sort of part of my cultural identity growing up. I was fully aware, and I wouldn't sort of necessarily look at some of this footage unless I was seeking it out on YouTube. But it is interesting knowing what you know now and then watching footage of her talking at press conferences with Charles and the looks she gives him and the quips that she says and the way he looks at her when, you know, all the focus is on her and the way he looks at her in walkabouts. You're now seeing the truth of that, where we didn't know it because we had no hindsight on this when we were watching it at the time. So it's fascinating to watch, I think.
Absolutely. I have to say, I went back and had to Google loads of things. It was like, is it true that a royal princess has to be a virgin? Is that why they seeked her out age 16 and then got her married off at 19 because they thought she was a virgin? All of these things I had never thought about. There was a lot in this documentary that, just like Jane said, we grew up with her. I remember the day of her funeral. I was stuck in my driving days. I was stuck on the A406 in traffic because traffic literally stopped that day in London on the day of her funeral. People loved her so much. When they opened the Diana Memorial, people from all over the world flocked to see her. And she did a lot of good in her time. I didn't probably realize it as much, you know, when that was happening. But looking at it in retrospect, it was like, wow, she was a real ambassador for Britain. You know, I just absolutely loved how this was put together. And I personally feel that it's one to watch on the big screen, even if the footage doesn't look pristine. You know, they've literally scrounged for pieces of information that they've then cut into this movie. But yes, please watch it on the big screen is what I'd say, because it is well worth a watch. If you were interested in her life and interested in her legacy, because that legacy, as Neil mentioned, still lives on. Whatever happened to Diana, we've seen happen to other members in their family too. And this kind of puts that focus on what's happening on the fringe of Diana, but through Diana being on screen quite a lot and the real Diana as opposed to a version of her.
Exactly.
One thing I would say is that considering how many hours of footage, hundreds, thousands of hours of footage that Ed Perkins and his editors, Jinx Godfrey and Daniel Lapira, had, it's a real kind of masterful piece of assembly. The fact they may kind of put it together and retell a story which we've heard 100 times, we've seen dramatized goodness knows how many times, and to give it kind of like, you know, the tempo and the drive of a sort of real life drama unfolding before our eyes, I think it's a real excellent piece of edited composition, as well as a real sort of powerful and affecting drama documentary.
Yeah, it just really does show that what you can do with editing and music and, you know, news footage. Yeah, as you say, the drama you can get out of that. I also like the fact that it opens with the, you know, literally the man on the street. It's a group of friends driving around Paris and witnessing the absolute scrum outside the Ritz the night she died and going, oh, look, Princess Diana's in town, and the circus of that from a point of view, not from a news crew or from a paparazzi, but from somebody literally passing by that sort of scrum. Very interesting choice of clips and, yeah, fascinating to watch. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Princess Diana, The Princess is out in cinemas on Friday. So that is all we have time for this week. What would be your film of the week, Neil?
I think it would be The Princess. I think that I kind of like Elizabeth. I think it shows there is a role for a royal documentary, you know, if you approach it in the right way.
Mm. Ashanti.
I know this is the unpopular opinion here, but I'm going to go for Minions. I had fun and you'll have fun too. Sometimes you just need a fun, you know, something fun to watch.
Yeah, I'm going to go for Nitram. Even though I didn't like it, I think it's something that will promote a really good chat in a restaurant or a pub afterwards if you go and see it with someone. And as Neil sort of alluded to, there is a sort of a connection between The Princess and that film in terms of what do we do with notoriety and how do we serve that? Okay, so we will be back next week with another episode. And we should mention as well that the new issue is out with Thor on the cover. So do go out and buy that. It's a cracker. But before we go, we have time for another question from a listener. And it's a perfect one. I picked this out because it goes with what we just talked about. Who is the best movie princess? Ashanti.
Princess Leia Organa, hands down.
I thought you might say that.
We've seen her feisty, tiny avatar in the new Obi-Wan Kenobi on Disney Plus. I mean, she grew up into this kind of great and strong leader, revolutionary. She used the Force really wisely. And we kind of saw the pesky little version of her when she was a child and loved her to bits in the show. What can I say? She is my princess.
Neil, who's your princess on screen?
I'm going to go back to Audrey Hepburn in Roman Holiday and Princess Anne. It was just such a charming idea of a sort of runaway princess enjoying a life of normality for one evening. And you could kind of bring in the princess as the sort of like the idea of how lovely it is to kind of give a princess, even a fictional one, sort of a night off and a chance to experience, like, you know, everything that she can't behind the walls of the palace. And Audrey Hepburn, won an Oscar for it and gave such a wonderful, indelible sort of performances next to Gregory Peck in that film. And you can go to Rome and you can kind of retrace her footsteps,
which I have done. And put my hand in the Bocca della Verità.
Who hasn't? Yeah, it's just a lovely film that you can kind of revisit again and again. So that's my choice of the best movie princess.
Cool. I'm going to go for Moana, a princess who is not allowed off her island, not allowed in any danger, and takes that boat out anyway.
Yes.
And she is kick-ass. She is more than a match for Dwayne Johnson's demigod. And, she manages to outsmart a giant crab. She is an absolute badass. I love her. So Moana. Moana for me. I think she'll jump some all. Okay, so on that note, I think it's time to go. So do say goodbye, Ashanti.
Goodbye.
And Neil.
Goodbye.
Goodbye for me. See you next week.